and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, part two of our look at who killed President Kennedy, 50 years on from his assassination. Also, abolish empty office buildings. Well, that's something we all want to do. But one man in Bristol, Tony Crofts, is actually doing it with a share issue. Plus also, eco-villages and Jeff Sparks' What's On Guide. But we start this week with part two of our three-part series on the Kennedy assassination. Now, the reason we're looking at the assassination of US President John F. Kennedy is because this November, it's 50 years since it happened. And if anyone tells you the Warren Commission decided the case will never be solved, don't believe them. Many believe there was a cover-up by the Warren Commission who was supposed to look into the assassination. That those responsible were so ruthless and embedded in the US military-industrial complex that the assassination was carried out by the mob and approved by the director of the CIA himself, Alan Dulles. The only prosecutions ever brought were by New Orleans' fearless district attorney, James Garrison, who wrote his own book, On the Trail of the Assassins. But we'll be hearing direct from Jim himself and others in a 1988 interview when not only was his prosecution completed, but as a result, many other witnesses had subsequently come forward to Jim to add to the picture. So over the next couple of weeks, as part of Dialect's summer schedule, we'll be taking you back 25 years to the Garrison interview and the full 50 years to 1963, even with the voice of the murdered suspect Lee Harvey Oswald himself being interviewed in his role as a spokesperson for Fair Play for Cuba Committee. We'll also hear from John Davis, who's also author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello and the Assassination of JFK, and also filmmaker Oliver Stone. The original 1988 programme is narrated by Roscoe Mercer. It was produced, written and edited by David Mendelsohn and Andrew Phillips. The 1993 presentation was produced for Guns and Butter on KPFA Radio in California, part of the Pacifica Network by Bonnie Forkler and Yara Marco. This week, part two.
The reception line is formed and there is Mrs. Kennedy, the First Lady, stepping from the plane, wearing a bright pink suit with a dark fur collar and a matching pink hat, and the president, wearing a dark suit, steps off directly behind. Mrs. Kennedy has been presented her bouquet of brilliant red roses, and they make a lovely contrast to the bright pink suit she is wearing. The weather couldn't be better. We have a brilliant sun at this moment. The wind has diminished considerably, and it has turned into a comfortable situation for the hundreds of people who came here to Dulles Love Field to witness the arrival of the president and his first lady. And here comes the president now. In fact, he's not in his limousine. He's departed the limousine and he is walking. He is reaching across the fence, shaking hands with many of the people who have come here to see him. He is closely accompanied by Dulles police officers and, of course, the Secret Service.
I was curious after I found out how unquestionably, how clear it was that Oswald was an agent provocateur, that he was working for government intelligence from the outset. I was wondering, how did the U.S. government, the intelligence community, handle his co-workers so that they wouldn't be telling too many people? Well, he didn't get many assignments. This was just a nesting place. He didn't have to do too much. So I sent my chief investigator over there, and he was back in an hour and a half with a list of paper. And every man that had been working with Oswald at the Riley Coffee Company or above him had been, within 2 weeks, had been moved out to a higher paying job out at NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Brannion had gone to Chrysler. This man had gone to Boeing. This man was working for NASA itself. Another man was working for NASA. The same thing happened to anybody who helped in the assassination. For example, we arrested David Ferry within 72 hours of the assassination when we stumbled across the fact that he drove across a former friend of Lee Oswald's when he was in the CAP. Dover, of course, we had a Sunday meeting to review the whole thing. This Kennedy's body's still warm. And we found out that this odd character, David Ferry, who later we learned was working with Oswald out of Bannister's office, had driven across the state line into Texas the day of the assassination. So we waited for him to come back, and when he came back on Monday morning, I had him arrested, brought to my house and office, and said, what your reason for going into Texas at this strange time? And he explained he hadn't been ice skating in years and was seized with the urge to go ice skating. So I said, well, that's very interesting, but how did you happen to pick the heaviest storm in many years to drive to? Well, he couldn't think of an answer to that, so I had him taken over to the FBI, the first district, to be held for the FBI for investigation. You couldn't give these guys, I'm trying to give these guys, the assassins, the people who set him up for the case, and they dropped a ferry like a hot potato. They even made a public announcement, because I guess members of the intelligence community recognized one another, made a public announcement that it was not the FBI's idea to arrest Mr. Ferry, but it was Jim Garrison's. But we got one of the guys involved pretty darn early by accident. We were looking for somebody who was associated with Lee Oswald, and even though he apparently was a agent provocateur, as more and more as it turned out, we wanted to see who was associated with him. We found soon enough that David Ferry was with him frequently. So we had a rejected complaint because it was such a minor case, but it had his address on it. And so we went over to Dave Ferry's house to see what was happening, and we found several kids, friends of his, waiting there for him, and they admitted he'd gone to Texas, waiting for him to come back from Texas. And I noticed a map of Cuba on the wall, all kinds of rifles, all kinds of military equipment, and I realized I wasn't dealing with Joe Smith American, and so we waited for him to come back, and that's when I questioned him, and he didn't answer the question very effectively. It was, and to make a long story short, we got the right guy, and as the House Committee, although it didn't do a very effective job, it did conclude that there was a conspiracy, and went on to say, 10 years later, one of the signs that a conspiracy existed was Lee Oswald's association with David Ferry. It said that's very strange, but that suggests the possibility of a conspiracy. That's what I was trying to say 10 years earlier. But then it went on to say, but now it was too late to look into.
And there's the gunmetal gray limousine, blue and gray, pulling away now from the fenced area. The President and Mrs. Kennedy seated on the back seat, Governor and Mrs. Connolly on the second seats or jump seats, and then the official driver and Secret Service men in the front seat. A flying wedge of some one dozen Dallas police motorcycles leading the way, and the pace is picking up as they head for the departure gate and the trip downtown to the Trade Mart.
I think this is probably a good point for me to jump in with my hostile question, so to speak. David Ferry, I understand, the weekend of the assassination, or the Friday of the assassination, was working for Carlos Marcello, who was alleged...
Isn't that funny? I have the impression he was working for his boss, Private Detective Ray Gill, but I'll let you take your own speculations.
I hear you, but Gill was Marcello's attorney at the time.
On that particular weekend, that's right. And the next week, he was somebody else's attorney, at which time David Ferry was still working for Ray Gill.
I hear you, and I want to hear more. I want to just put in the question that, as you say, the big theory that's being put forward now is that elements of organized crime were responsible for killing Kennedy.
Let's go straight to that. And you've got a clock watch. Let me just see how many seconds it takes me to dispose in the minds of a reasonable man of organized crime being involved. First of all, the reason given for the contended organized crime, and the listener should understand that this idea was conceived and is spread consistently by the Central Intelligence Agency, so that you will look away from its covert operations and its other murders. The reason given for the supposed involvement of organized crime is so that they could get rid of the Attorney General. Well, if you want to get rid of the Attorney General, truly, all you have to do Bobby Kennedy, it was at the time, is shoot him when he goes to his Justice Department office in the morning or on the way out in the afternoon, because he didn't even have a bodyguard. All he had was a driver who was also the bodyguard. Now compare that to getting rid of him in the way that the agency wants you to believe the mafia. They say you've got to give the mob credit for having more sense than this. To have to penetrate the huge guard around the President of the United States, the Secret Service protection, the FBI protection, all the other agencies, the protection of the police and the city, in order ultimately to cause his attorney general to end up without a job, is really not very logical. But let's take another step further. One of the most critical steps in accomplishing the murder was the change of the parade route at the last second. On the morning of the parade, the Dallas Morning News showed that the parade route for the president was to continue as it came to Dealey Plaza, continue on Main Street all the way through Dealey Plaza. That map was 5/6, leaving just one column on the left of the front page, showing so everybody could see the route of the president. Now, what actually happened was when the presidential motorcade came and reached Dealey Plaza, without warning, it turned right. It turned right down Houston and left into Elm. It was a cul-de-sac where the ambush was waiting. And secondly, that double turn, the last leg of which was 120 degrees to the left, slowed his vehicle down to 10 miles an hour, where you could hit him with a rock. If he had been going 25 miles an hour, as he had been, would be out in the meadow as planned, through the center of Dealey Plaza on Main, they would have been able to hit the side of the car with it. But anyway, that's what happened. The parade was changed at the last moment. The parade of the President of the United States.
Now, those of you who are waiting along the parade route, just to be sure that you find yourself in the proper location, let's give it to you once again. It will go Mockingbird Lane to Lemon Avenue, then travel south on Lemon to Turtle Creek, Cedar Springs, through the downtown area on Harwood to Main, west on Main to Houston, through the Triple Underpass to Stemmons Freeway, then on to the Trademark.
President's car is now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the Trademark. I was on Stemmons Freeway earlier, and even the freeway was jam-packed with spectators waiting their chance to see the president as he made his way toward the Trademark. It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Stemmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. I repeat, a shooting in the motorcade in the downtown area. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. The president's car is now going past me. The limousine is now traveling at a very high rate of speed. Secret Service men standing up in the limousine. They are armed with submachine guns. It appears as though someone in the limousine might have been hit by the gunfire. Put me on, Phil. Put me on. Hello, am I on? We're here at the Trademark. The motorcade is coming by here. I can see many, many motorcycles coming by now. Police motorcycles. Just heard a call on the radio for all units along Industrial to pick up the motorcade. Something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connolly are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong. I'm in behind the motorcade, trying to follow them. It looks as though they're going to Parkland Hospital. We're on the road to Parkland at this time. The Secret Service man is still spread eagle over whoever is in the car, the President and Mrs. Kennedy, and as we understand, Governor and Mrs. Connolly. At this point, it looks as though it could have been one or two or even all of the people within the car may have been the victims, may have been struck by shots. We don't know. Parkland Hospital in the distance. Now on Harry Hines Boulevard, following behind the motorcade. Many, many police officers, maybe 20 or 25 motorcycle policemen, falling in behind at Trademark. A huge car left behind, waiting expectantly to see the president. The motorcade now now perhaps 2 or 3 blocks ahead of me. They're approaching the entrance now to Parkland Hospital, traveling at a high rate of speed. Ready police cars converging on Parkland from every angle.
I've been ridiculed and worse for suggesting the existence of a conspiracy, as though only kooks and cranks and extremists suggest their existence. But this is the wrong city in which to ridicule people who believe in conspiracies.
On January 15th, 1992, Oliver Stone, director of JFK, spoke before the National Press Club in Washington and took questions from the audience.
Is it inconceivable that a president of the United States could sit at the heart of a criminal conspiracy designed to cover up a crime? We know what happened. We would have impeached him for it had he not resigned. Just one jump ahead. Is it so far-fetched to believe in a high-level conspiracy involving the White House, the Joint Chiefs, the Air Force, and the CIA to bomb a neutral country and lie about it in military reports to the rest of the country? But it happened, perhaps more than once. Is it inconceivable that the National Security Council leadership, with or without the knowledge of the President of the United States and with the collaboration of the director of the CIA, not just a few rogues, could be engaged in a massive conspiracy to ship arms to our sworn enemy with a casual hope that a few hostages might be released as a result? But it happened. Does it offend our sense of propriety to suggest that an Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America might have regularly lied to Congress about raising money abroad to perform things that Congress had forbidden us to do? But that happened. Is it inconceivable that a campaign manager, later to become the CIA director, negotiated with a foreign country to keep American hostages imprisoned until after a presidential election in order to ensure the election of his candidate? We shall see. But I think no one thinks it is out of the question anymore. So when JFK suggests that a conspiracy involving elements of a government, people in the CIA, people in the FBI, perhaps people associated with the Joint Chiefs, all in the service of the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about, might have conspired to kill John Fitzgerald Kennedy because he was going sharply to change the direction of American foreign policy, is it not appropriate at least to look there for evidence? What was Alan Dulles really up to in those months? Or Charles Cabell, also fired by JFK, or his brother Earl Cabell, the mayor of Dallas? Thomas Jefferson urged on us the notion that when truth can compete in a free marketplace of ideas, it will prevail. There is as yet no marketplace of history for the years of the Kennedy assassination and immediately afterward. Let us begin to create one.
You've been listening to The Assassination of JFK, the Garrison interview. This is Guns and Butter.
I have to reiterate one more time that this is not just another murder, not just another assassination, but I insist, I would stake my life on it. Much as I love this country will not survive as a republic if they continue. The Congress and the presidency, the two offices I now hold most responsible, if they continue to fool the people about Jack Kennedy and continue to postpone telling them the truth, our country will not survive.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview Part 2. In this 1988 radio documentary, you'll hear the voice of co-producer and writer David Mendelsohn interviewing former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello, and the Assassination of JFK, John Davis, and filmmaker Oliver Stone. Roscoe Mercer narrates. The Assassination of JFK, the Garrison interview, was co-produced, edited, and directed by Andrew Phillips.
The shots apparently came from the fifth floor of the Texas Bookstore Depository building, possibly from an automatic type weapon. Police were looking for a young white man dressed in a white shirt with Levi's, carrying a lever-action type rifle. One witness told reporters that he had seen the rifle disappearing from that window after the shots were fired. Senator Ralph Yarbrough told a KVOX reporter that he was riding three cars behind the president's car when he heard three distinct rifle shots. The motorcade then increased in speed, running to Parkland Hospital.
Just a moment. We have a bulletin coming in. We now switch you directly to Parkland Hospital and KBOX News Director Bill Hampton.
The President of the United States is dead. I have just talked to Father Oscar Hubert of the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. He and another priest tell me that a pair of men have just administered the last rites of the Catholic Church to President Kennedy. I asked the father, is Mr. Kennedy dead? And his quote, he's dead all right. And just a few seconds ago, I talked to Thurman Ward, the Justice of Peace of Garland. He's now here at the hospital to apparently officially declare that the chief executive of the United States has expired. President Kennedy has been assassinated. It's official now. The president is dead.
This is a story about that moment in America when the government changed and the people were excluded. Not just from choosing their leader, but from knowing why their leadership changed. Millions of Americans have seen Oliver Stone's movie, JFK, which focuses on Garrison's investigation in 1967. But very few have heard Judge Garrison recount his work and his message for America in his own words. This is a story about that day in Dallas, the day John Kennedy died.
I think that bringing out the truth is so critical that these words must be said. The American people have to face the fact that this is not an oversight, not a mistake on somebody's part. Every day that passes, high individuals at the very top of the United States government are playing an active role in concealing from you the truth of John Kennedy's murder. Most of the men that are in the Congress who have an IQ of 100 above, or let's say even 50 and above, have to know he was brutally murdered and torn apart, but they no longer really care, apparently, because his name is never even mentioned anymore. And look at the attitude of the presidents, one after the other. These are the chief executives of our country, and yet we've had a succession of presidents now, and not one even mentions the name of John Kennedy. Apparently, they expect us to believe that Jack Kennedy is on sabbatical up at Hyannisport, and everything's all right. Well, everything isn't all right. I suggest that if the government, including the presidents, and including presidents who speak softly of wanting a kinder, gentler nation, how about an honest, also a more honest nation that tells the people the truth, which it hasn't done? Until the presidents and the Congress itself do something about bringing out the truth, I do not think this republic will last. I think it will fall. And if this happens and it falls because the government will not tell the truth, then it deserves to fall.
There are many unanswered questions concerning the death of President Kennedy, and there are several credible theories. This is not a definitive examination of the tragic events of 1963, but the Garrison interview is an important audio document of a crucial and little understood moment of American history.
You're listening to Dialect on BCFM 93.2 in Bristol. And this is California-based community radio show Guns and Butters, presentation of a 1988 Pacifica radio documentary, The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview. This November marks 50 years since the 1963 assassination of the last US president to rein back rather than expand US military intervention around the world. And the New Orleans District Attorney, Jim Garrison, conducted the only judicial prosecution into the JFK assassination. You can find this full programme online at www.gunsandbutter.org and also, of course, at our own website, www.dialectradio.co.uk. Now, on with the show.
Let's go back to the weekend of the assassination and what tipped you off that New Orleans might really be at the center of a possible conspiracy. Guy Bannister was booked that night.
Well, first of all, those things did not tip me off that anything was happening. You must understand, and I plead guilty to believing the government's lie
The biggest lie it told in the history of the human race, I now see, was told by the United States government and continues to be told. But I am one of the people who believed it. And one of the reasons I believed it was I'd been in the Army all my life. 5 years in World War II, 18 years in the National Guard, and the Army had never deceived me or been deceptive, and the Army was a government to me. So I accepted these things without question. Now, the way that I happened to stumble across and gather and look into things from the what we found came across of Bannister's beating of Jack Martin, what you described in the police report is dated 22nd of November 1963, the night of the assassination, and how we happened, even though I believe the government's pronouncements, how my office happened to catch David Ferry when he came back in from his weekend trip to Texas, was because I was just doing my duty as a district attorney because the president had been killed. Lee Oswald had spent the summer in New Orleans, so we were pretty much, you might say, grabbing suspicious people. It just happens, in hindsight, it's clear, but by accident we grabbed people who were relevant, but we did not know that at the time. So that's why I promptly turned Ferry over to the FBI and things like that. And for the next 3 years, I concentrated on burglaries, armed robberies, murders, and so forth. So don't give me too much credit. I was not an early... I'm not that quick. I did not see that something was wrong, which I should have. It was apparent, but I didn't see it for 3 years.
Well, why did Bannister beat Martin that night?
The reason Bannister beat Jack Martin that night was Bannister, because of, probably not unrelated to his years as head of the FBI in Chicago, while he was capable of drinking heavily at night, and he would not drink during the day, and was sober as a judge during the day, but on the day of the assassination, he was with Jack Martin, who worked for him. Jack Martin did the detective work, and the office had on the front of it Guy Bannister, private detective. But all Guy Bannister did all day was work on the logistics and the problems of getting additional ammunition to Cuba for raids on Cuba and the training. He was totally working for the CIA, but Jack Martin, who was intelligent, did his detective work. So they were friends, even though they were vitally different, tremendously different personalities. But they'd both been drinking, and Bannister, for the first time to anybody's memory, got completely drunk on the afternoon of the assassination. So they got in an argument. It doesn't have to be a great reason between two drunks, and they were on the way home at nightfall, home meaning around the corner from the Catch and Jammer Bar on Camp Street, around the corner of Lafayette Street to Guy Bannister's office, and somewhere on the way upstairs, or on the second floor where the office was, Bannister blew up, and out of the blue, as Jack finally told me, said to Jack that he'd been looking into his filing cases. Well, of course, Bannister was very careful about his filing cases because there was nothing in there but intelligence. As we later learned out, there were no private cases at all. And they usually kept them locked. But Jack Martin, while he was something of a character, he nevertheless was a thoroughly honest man, and he was outraged. And he replied the best way he knew how, and as he said, he was referring to Lee Oswald at the time. He said, "Look, I saw some certain people coming in and out of your office all summer long, and I can say something about that if I want to." And at that point, Bannister, who did not just carry regular sidearm, carried a 357 Magnum, pulled out a 357 Magnum. This is something else he never done besides drink in the daytime. He pistol-whipped Martin until they had to get an ambulance over to cart the body away. That's the way that thing developed.
This on November 22nd.
Yes, because and the specific point again was it's funny how quickly it took in time when you stop. It was a matter of hours after the arrest of Oswald. He was arrested at 3 o'clock Dallas time, and this is roughly 5:45 or 6 New Orleans time, and already Too soon for Bannister. Already someone who Bannister knows has called his attention that he hasn't forgotten seeing Lee Oswald in and out of that office. So that's why he blew up.
Something I think we should get into, which Garrison never goes into in his book, is how Garrison became interested in reinvestigating the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
John Davis, author of Mafia Kingfish, Carlos Marcello, and the Assassination of JFK.
Is pretty certain that it was Senator Russell Long who convinced Garrison to reopen the investigation of the JFK assassination. Long was closely associated with Carlos Marcello. He was Marcello's man in Washington. And Marcello was Long's principal financial backer. It was Russell Long who persuaded Garrison that the CIA was behind the JFK murder. So, in a way, you have the sinister possibility that Garrison was being manipulated by Marcello forces to reopen the investigation and to point it in a different direction, point it away from organized crime and toward the CIA. We have to mention also that another individual who was responsible for convincing Garrison to reopen the investigation was Congressman from Louisiana, Hale Boggs, who was another supporter of Marcello, and Marcello was a backer of his campaigns. And curiously, Hale Boggs was appointed to the Warren Commission by President Johnson. And he also evidently persuaded Garrison that the CIA was behind the assassination. Carlos Marcello was the boss of the second largest mafia family in the United States, which operated throughout Louisiana, Mississippi, and parts of Texas, including Dallas and Houston. This criminal organization was doing a business of something like $2 billion a year in narcotics and extortion schemes, and prostitution rings, I mean, you name it, every conceivable crime you can think of. And so it was an immensely wealthy organization, and Marcello himself was supposed to have been the richest single mafia boss in the whole country. And he came under a sort of special attack by Robert Kennedy when he was Attorney General. He was singled out for special investigation and prosecution because Robert Kennedy was so appalled by this man and what he had gotten away with all his life. And there was a standing order of deportation against him. And Robert Kennedy did something extraordinary that no other attorney general ever did. He did an arguably illegal thing, which was to deport Carlos Marcello in an extra-legal way, to literally kidnap him off the streets of New Orleans, throw him on a government plane, and fly him down to Guatemala, where he was dumped, and Marcello later complained that he couldn't call his wife, he couldn't get his toothbrush, he couldn't go to the bank and cash a check. He was just dropped in Guatemala. After that, the Guatemalans deported him to El Salvador, and then he was deported from El Salvador to Honduras. And he spent something like 20 or 30 days hiking through jungles, where he collapsed several times and broke ribs. And it was a terrible ordeal. It was a very humiliating ordeal for such a powerful mafia boss. And he finally legally returned to the United States. And I found at least three reports, reliable reports, that he was swearing vengeance against the Kennedys when Hoffa was feeling so cornered by Bobby Kennedy, who was prosecuting him, was trying to put him in jail, and eventually succeeded. He felt so cornered that he turned to Regano to deliver a message. This is, of course, according to Regano's story, to deliver a message to Carlos Marcello that he wanted him killed. He wanted Kennedy killed. And more or less take care of it. Do it for me. And it's thought that one of the reasons why Marcello went along with this as he coveted the Teamsters Central States Pension Fund, which was had almost $1 billion in it. And it is thought that Hoffa promised Marcello $3 million from the fund if he pulled off the hit. Frank Regano was an attorney for Jimmy Hoffa and an attorney for Florida Mafia boss Santo Trafficante for years. And he also knew Carlos Marcello. And in 1979, a congressional committee determined that the three most likely suspects to have conspired to murder President Kennedy were Jimmy Hoffa, Santo Trafficante, and Carlos Marcello, the three people that Frank Regano was in constant touch with. So he is a logical, I would say he's a very logical witness to the conspiracy, which the House Select Committee identified but could not prove back in 79. David Ferry was earning his living at the time as an investigator for Carlos Marcello. He was working on a case which had been brought against Marcello by Attorney General Robert Kennedy. His principal allegiance at the time, his principal connection, was to mob boss Carlos Marcello. Guy Bannister, who was a former FBI agent and had intelligence connections, was also very close to Carlos Marcello. He regularly did investigatory work for him. The two were on very good terms. So I view Bannister more as a creature of Carlos Marcello than I do the CIA. And now we know that Lee Harvey Oswald was also connected to Carlos Marcello, probably perhaps more so than to any specific intelligence agency.
That was Guns and Butter's presentation of the 1988 Pacifica radio documentary, The Assassination of JFK, The Garrison Interview. And you can find this full programme online at www.gunsandbutter.org. That's gunsandbutter.org. And www.dialectradio.co.uk. That's dialectradio.co.uk. And it's the Kennedy assassination 50th anniversary this November.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And I'm joined by Tony Crofts, who runs a housing co-op up in Clifton. Tony, first of all, before we get into the nitty-gritty of your new initiative, how did you start a housing co-op and what is it?
It's people clubbing together, pooling their resources to acquire somewhere affordable and decent to live in.
Well, when you say affordable, nowadays a lot of people will think, well, actually, even affordable isn't affordable.
Well, affordable is, I think, within the limits of housing benefit.
And roughly how much is that?
Depends how many bedrooms you have. But for two bedrooms, it's about 625. For one bedroom, it's about 500.
OK, but with a co-op, isn't there something implied about shared ownership? So when somebody moves in, they're not just a tenant as an ordinary tenant. Don't they have some kind of stake in owning the property?
Yes, they are corporately owning the property, but it has an asset lock so that it can't be sold off for profit.
OK, so it can't be sold off. But doesn't that also mean, well, I mean, how do people make money at that sort of housing if the place can't be sold?
They don't make money out of it. They save money by not having to pay so much for the rents.
Well, it sounds almost idealistic, you know, that housing is not just there simply to make money out of people, because, you know, as we know, if you actually want to build a house, if you ignore the price of the land, you're probably talking about, you know, something like £60,000-£70,000 in terms of labour and materials to actually physically build the house, and yet which might last for 200 years, spread out over 200 years. If you're looking at a one payment every week to pay for that actual physical building, I mean, people should be paying maybe something like £1 a week in rent, but we're not. So what's wrong with the housing market?
What's wrong with the housing market is many of the bankers who insist on being paid back the capital you spend on building the house in the first place rather quicker than 100 years.
That's true. Also, what about land prices? Because it seems to be that many of these big developers, like Prince Charles, for example, they buy cheap agricultural land and then they get their planning permission and all of a sudden overnight That land is worth something like 1,000 times what it was when they bought it.
Yes, land value is the big bugbear, in fact. I mean, if you buy a house now, the rebuilding cost for insurance purposes is less than half the price you pay. The rest is for the land.
Amazing. So anyway, something's dreadfully wrong with our housing market, and we've got something like 15,000. I mean, I've even heard from people from the council themselves wanting to put out a mailing to everybody on Bristol's housing list that there may be up to 19,000 people on that housing list. There's a lot of people out there that need proper housing, even though they may be, for example, sleeping on a sofa, you know, that kind of thing, that they are actually officially classed as homeless.
Yes, well, I mean, Bristol has been forced to sell off 13,860 council houses under right to buy, and has, as you say, this very large housing waiting list as a result. And these people aren't scroungers, they're people on normal working incomes who simply can't afford to buy or rent a home.
Okay, so what are you planning to do about it? I mean, I know you. We've had you on here before talking about the massive number of empty offices in the city, acres and acres of empty office space when people desperately need housing.
Well, the government has now made an initiative to make it easier to convert offices into affordable homes, and we aim to start doing this in Bristol to try and replace some of the lost council housing. And because we're a co-op, we shan't be subject to right to buy, so we'll be able to keep them permanently affordable in perpetuity.
OK, well, that sounds great. Whereabouts are you planning to do this?
Well, we have our eye on a site in Whitehall Road, but the first thing we're going to do is go and see the Whitehall Community Forum and see what they want, because we want to create affordable housing with a real sense of community. That'll be family flats with good gardens for kids to play in, and also some one-bedroom flats to accommodate people who are being forced out by the bedroom tax and that kind of thing, and also a good meeting room or even maybe a community cafe.
Well, that sounds good. What about actually raising the money to do this, though, Tony?
Well, we're proposing to launch a community share, a cooperative community share, and raise most of the money by crowdfunding. That's people putting in what they can towards it. And then we shall take a bank loan to cover the conversion and building costs.
Oh, hang on. Once you've got that bank loan, surely you're going to be mortgaged up to the hilt till kingdom come.
Well, we shall have to charge the highest rents that we can while being affordable in order to meet bank repayments for the first year or two. But because we're a co-op, our tenants will be favoured by 50% council tax discount, and we will design the homes to be ultra energy efficient, so they're very low running cost, and we can also pledge not to raise rents for 5 to 10 years, so that we'll very quickly get into the really affordable area.
Well, hang on a minute, because I mean, the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, it was the councils that were building these types of affordable housing. Why aren't they doing so now? Why is it being left to people like you, Tony, to actually, you know, to do these things? Surely it's city councils, county councils, these kinds of people that have got the resources to do this kind of thing.
That's because Mrs. Thatcher wanted to turn working class voters into conservative voters by encouraging them to get into property speculation by buying their own homes, and forbade the councils to use the proceeds they got from selling them to build more houses.
Yeah, you talked about a community share issue. What are you actually asking for people in Bristol to dig into their pockets and hand over money to you, are you?
Yes, indeed. And I think people who have got money in Bristol need to start thinking, if we don't keep working people in the city, if we drive them out, who's going to mow their lawn or wipe their backside when they're elderly?
Well, it's a good question.
I mean, London is pretty soon not going to have enough working people to run its services. That's how serious the situation is.
Well, it does sound crazy. Of course, the other thing is that we've got this ridiculous surfeit of empty offices, and yet it seems that almost the only thing that's now being built, other than luxury flats, is offices. What is the situation like in the city? I think it's great, by the way, that you've taken this initiative. Rather than just cursing these empty offices as you drive past in your car or walk past, to actually do something about turning them into affordable homes.
Well, it's because of an accounting falsehood which says that empty, unused buildings have a higher capital value on company balance sheets than lived-in used ones, which is clearly a criminal falsehood.
Well, you say that, but, I mean, you know, that seems to be the norm nowadays, that a lot of the... I mean, this is partly due to quantitative easing, isn't it? This whole thing that the Bank of England's policy that they've been doing over the last few years is pumping money into assets. That is to say, things that people have got in their savings are going up. And even shares in companies that aren't doing very well are still going up, whereas the real economy seems to be being starved of cash.
Yeah, and I mean, companies are just hanging on to office buildings in the hope of renting them out by the square foot at a high office rent rather than a livable rent for living in.
OK, well, tell us a little bit more about this community share issue, because, I mean, for many people, they will be looking around where to invest their money if they've got any. Of course, most people out there are actually in debt rather than having money to invest. But if they have got money to invest, what makes you think that they might put that money with you? Are you giving them a reasonable rate of return? Have you got some kind of security?
There have been a number of very successful community share issues recently, one for a solar voltaic farm. They've raised money that way for the rescuing the Bristol ferry boats. And in fact, crowdfunding is a surprisingly successful way of raising money. And we expect to be able to offer 3% in the first year while we're building and work up towards 5% interest thereafter. And as a co-op, we're allowed to pay interest on loans that people invest with us.
Well, that's a reasonable rate of return, considering what you might get in a savings account nowadays. But it's not really up to what some investment funds are getting on the stock exchange, is it?
No, indeed. But there are an awful lot of people who want their money to go where it's going to do some good rather than just to speculate and make pennies.
What about the guarantee that you're actually going to be able to get your money back at the end of the day? Because obviously that is always a little bit iffy when you're investing in the stock exchange.
Well, the money is going to be secured on the property. And as the property will be sound and of good market value, there should be no difficulty about, if need be, raising money to repay people or repaying them out of rents as the rents go on.
Now, what about if people want their money back? Maybe they've invested some money with you. How long do they have to leave it with you for, and when can they get the money back if they need it?
We're hoping they'll put money in for at least 3, if not 5 years, to enable us to get well started. But I've done this up in Oxfordshire with the Community Land Trust there, and we started off with almost no money at all. But we have only had 2 rent rises in 20 years, and our rents are now cheaper than council rents, and we still are managing a surplus. And we have repaid all the people who lent us money.
How do you manage to do that?
Out of the rents that we collect, we put aside a certain amount each month, invest it usually in a unit trust to build up capital to repay with.
Is it really that simple? Because it seems that, I mean, why doesn't everybody do this? Why doesn't everybody buy their homes and their properties like this? Because it seems that most of us are put in the situation where we're having to pay far more for our housing really throughout our lives than it is actually worth.
Well, I think as water, land and food are getting shorter in the world, we're all going to have to learn to share more. And I think cooperatives are the way forward.
Well, certainly maybe one way forward. Anyway, Tony, very interested to hear your proposal. How do listeners get hold of you, or if they've got interested to find out more about what you're doing, how do they do that?
We have a website, AEOB, House People, all one word, .org.uk, and AEOB stands for Abandon Empty Office Buildings.
Abandon empty office... Abandon them or they are abandoned? Abandon or abandoned?
Well, abolish them.
Abolish empty office buildings. I like it. What about telephone for those people that are on the internet, Tony?
0117 926 5931.
Do you want to just give that number again in case people didn't have a pen handy? And we'll probably... Yes, let's give it again at the end of the programme too.
OK. 0117 926 5931.
OK, and that gets through to you, does it?
It does indeed, yes.
Fantastic. And the website once more?
AEOB House People, all one word, .org.uk.
Well, Tony Crofts, good luck with it. Thanks very much for joining us. No Jeff this week, so you have to put up with me, I'm afraid. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect, starting with Friday the 2nd of August. Dharma Sunset will be performing with support from Tiny Dragons at the Birdcage in 28 Clare Street, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and doors are open at 7pm. Also on the 2nd of August, Cowder Pavanis will be performing with support from Holding Tides and Gag Reflex at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road. Tickets are £4 in advance and all proceeds go to Children's Hospice South West. Doors open at 7:30pm. Song of the Week, and I present Johnny Winter. He's an American blues guitarist, singer and producer. His career spans over 30 years and in that time he's released 18 albums. Here's a song that was recorded in 1970 entitled Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. That was Johnny Winter with Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. Finally, on Sunday, the 4th of August, Monster Magnet will be performing with support from God-Sized and also Hark at the Fleece in St Thomas's Street, Bristol. Tickets £18 in advance. Doors open at 7:30pm. That's all for me. Thanks for listening and take care and have a good week. Goodbye.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
That's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2pm every Friday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which reminds you every Tuesday evening when we go online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, www.bgfm.co.uk. Thanks to this week's studio guest, that's Tony Crofts. His number again is 0117 926 5931. 0117 926 5931. And he's from Abolish Empty Office Buildings. Website www.aeobhousepeople.org.uk. Thanks to studio engineer also, Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye.
Here's what we want you to do. Come on and sing with us.